Well, thank you, everyone, for coming. I always like to say my husband and kids are so sick of me talking about this topic. I'm always thrilled when people want to hear it. So thank you. I should say, I always like to start by asking the audience, you know, how many people here have experienced, have opened incomprehensible medical bills with impossibly high charges that made no sense? Hands? Okay. Well, that's why I wrote the book, basically, because I am both a physician and a consumer of healthcare, and I'll tell you a little bit about this story. Everyone knows that U.S. healthcare is a expensive, unsatisfying mess that doesn't yield, on average, particularly good results. Although I want to point out that everyone in my series and in the book, for the most part, got the results they wanted, but the process was so painful and really overshadowed their experiences of healthcare and medicine, that financial process. So anyway, I wanted to understand how it got this way, how we got into this mess. And I felt like I needed to know it and that I was in a particularly good position to try and figure it out. My dad was a doctor. He was a pediatric hematologist in the 60s and 70s. I trained as a physician. It's kind of what people in my family do. And I'd always loved writing, and I was always trying to decide which one I would pursue as a career. And I actually trained in internal medicine and then went to work in an emergency room in New York. And did that for a few years, and it was in the early 90s. I was writing a lot on the side, and there was something called the Clinton Health Reform Plan in that time. I don't know how many of you remember that, but I was working in a New York City emergency room at the time, and I really felt like I wanted to write about that because, by and large, in the early 90s, the system was still working pretty well for people like me who had good employer-provided insurance. You know, there were premiums were paid mostly by your employer, and the premiums and the deductibles and co-payments, if they existed, were pretty minimal. But the system even then wasn't working for the patients I was seeing in the emergency room, or many of them, you know, who were poor, under and uninsured. So I decided to go to the New York Times to write about health policy, and my assumption was at that time that the Clinton health reform would pass, and I would go back to being a doctor. And of course, it didn't, and I didn't. I got kind of hooked on the journalism thing. And, you know, through that long process of starting watching my dad, I felt like I'd kind of, and then being a doctor, going through training, experiencing it all as a patient, and then becoming an investigative journalist, I felt like I had kind of a front row seat to what I now think of as a kind of slow-moving heist of our healthcare from an endeavor that was about caring and curing and science to an endeavor that is still about those things, but whose results and whose metrics are defined primarily right now by the finances. So how did that happen? That to me was what we used to call in medical school the $64,000 question. I now call it the $3.2 trillion question for our healthcare budget. And I think what I figured out is that, you know, where's all that money going? You know, we all know we pay 2 to 3 times more for almost everything than in any other country. And I think the answer is it's going to business, to profit, to however you want to define that, and we'll talk a little bit more. So anyway, after I didn't go back to medicine, I spent a number of years kind of a little bit dismayed about what had happened to the Clinton health reform effort and took a bunch of foreign assignments. And that's kind of relevant here. It was not about healthcare mostly. I was in China, I was in Europe. And I was writing about things as varied as Chinese politics, and then I became the Times' international environment correspondent, which was a wonderful job. But what's relevant about that for this is that in the process of doing that, I experienced a lot of other healthcare systems. One of my kids had a hip infection and was taken to Hong Kong for treatment. I'm going to sound really accident prone now. I'm a runner. I fell and I broke my wrist in Stockholm. The Times had me sent to this kind of fancy orthopedist who, in a small office, looked at my hand, sent me next door for an x-ray in a not very fancy place, casted it, and then apologized really profusely for charging me $400. That seemed. Yeah. And now this is where I get really accident prone. I cut open my forehead in Rome on a weekend. I knew it needed stitches, and so I, not knowing where to go really, I picked the Pope's Hospital, Gemelli Hospital. I thought, well, can't be bad. So I went in there. It didn't look like any hospital in the U.S. It was pretty basic looking, and I think that's one of the things I want all of us to be thinking about. But I got my 8 stitches. It was through my eyebrows, so a pretty sensitive place. Great care, and I was charged about $112 for that. But for me, and as I was in my travels, I was hearing from my friends in the U.S. that, wow, healthcare is getting pretty expensive. I was away between 97 and 2007. But the turning point for me and pulling me back to writing about healthcare and to outrage was I returned in 2007 at that age where one goes through that kind of entry point into middle age. Was I needed my first screening colonoscopy, right? So not many people talk about that at book talks, but here we go. And I'm a wonk. I'm a healthcare wonk. And I'd heard things had gotten really expensive. My internist said, "Well, I can refer you to this other guy, but it's going to cost you. They're out-of-pocket charges. He's not in your network." So I went to the Times HR people and said, "How do I get this without having to pay an arm and a leg?" And they said, "You just stay in our network." And they gave me a list of places in New York or told me where to go to find that. And there was a certain cancer hospital in New York that ran a screening colonoscopy clinic. So I thought, okay. I had trained there partly as a resident. I trusted it. So I signed up. And the day it said, I did my, the prelude to a screening colonoscopy. And I went to the room I was told to go to on the day of my test. And I was a little confused because it was the admitting office at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And I thought, wow, this is a little weird. I'm just here for this basic test. I got my hospital band. I went through the admitting process. I got my bonnet. They took my clothes, was put on a stretcher. And then I was wheeled into an area that was basically a full-blown operating room, with beeping monitors, nurses running around in scrubs, anesthesiologists. And I was a little bit like, I was perplexed more than anything else by the whole thing. I was like, wow, this isn't. I remembered watching screening colonoscopies in medical school in a doctor's office, so I was a little confused about why I was in an operating room at Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. But my push of propofol ended my worries. I fell asleep and woke up being told that I had a clean bill of colon health, which was great. And I didn't really think much more about it until about a month later when I got my explanation of benefits, which I look at because I'm kind of a wonk. And I saw that screening colonoscopy had been billed at $11,000. Then you get the chirpy message from your insurer saying, "On your behalf, we have bargained with the hospital, so we paid only," and it was around $9,000. And then there's that last happy line, "So you owe zero." And I guess, I should have been happy with that. And I was really glad they didn't put what I've seen on some other explanation of benefits subsequently, like, "So you saved 99%," which always it infuriates me. So I guess I should have been happy because I didn't have to pay. But I was really upset about it because I know, as I think we all know now, that a nation that pays $11,000 or $9,000 or even $5,000 for screening colonoscopies is a nation which ends up right where we are now, with paying nearly 20% of our GDP on healthcare, people with facing huge rises in premiums, high deductible plans, copays, because when the costs go up and the prices go up to an unreasonable amount, your insurer or the pharma company or the hospital, they're not going to eat those costs. They're going to pass them on to you. It's not their business model to absorb them, right? So I always kind of get amused when people say, you know, when there's this notion of your insurer is in your corner that's promoted by these explanation of benefits statements, and I'm like, no, they're not. I mean, do you think of your car insurer as being in your corner? No. You know, they are pass-throughs, and they take in premiums and pay out claims, and if the claims go up to unreasonable prices or unbearable prices, then what are their strategies? You know, these are their primary obligations to their shareholders, mostly, because they're for-profit companies. So their strategy is they raise premiums, they can pass on cost to you in the form of higher deductibles or higher copays, and that's exactly what we're seeing now. So I think we all have to be conscious, and we'll talk more about this, that, you know, when the what you owe now is zero, it's not really zero. It may be zero what you owe now, but what you will pay in the future is a lot for that zero payment now. And I wanted to say, you know, as I started researching this topic, I discovered that in Germany and in Austria, the cost, if you're paying out of pocket for a colonoscopy, which you do there because there's fee for service but with set fees, is about $400. So that may be too low, okay? But you know, I'm just trying to point out the huge price disparities we see. So anyway, I always feel like before I talk about this, I have to say that I don't think this should be a dialogue of patients versus their physicians. You'll see in the book, many of my best sources were and are, continue to be, physicians who are deeply, deeply upset about the direction that this healthcare system has gone in, who don't like it that their patients are being ripped off. Who send me bills. There's a wonderful story in the book of a physician a surgeon in northern Wisconsin, in a very red part of the state, who you know, had taken out someone's appendix, and the person came in to him a week later for the follow-up check and said, "I feel great, but you know what, doc? Did you know the hospital charged me $25,000 for that stay?" And the surgeon, Dr. Recksteiner, said to me, "You know, I realized I'd saved his life, I'd healed him, but I'd bankrupted his family, and I didn't feel good about that." So, P.S., this physician and this surgeon and his fellow surgeons there started a campaign Medicare opt-in or Medicare for all. So, you know, that's not to say that that is the answer, but I think the pain that many physicians are seeing their patients go through are changing the way both physicians and patients think about healthcare. So, you know, in a country with, you know, looked at from the 30,000-foot view, in a country with 29 million still uninsured, we've got a lot of work to do. The ACA did some really important things. It gave insurance to 20 million more people. It's going to be hard to take that away, as we're seeing now in the town hall meetings. It gave insurance to people with pre-existing conditions. I think we're seeing that the Republican replacement plans are going to have a hard time meeting that obligation, or what's considered now an obligation. And also it kind of established the idea in our heads that the government should care about this. It should make it a national goal to get everyone access to decent health care that's affordable. So in order to do that, whether it's the ACA or the HCA, I think one thing we're going to have to really come to terms with is the prices and costs of our healthcare system, and how can we get that under control? Because the truth is that healthcare is kind of a Rubik's Cube that you can't fit together unless you control these prices. So we'll talk more about how to do that later. I think, you know, we see now both from a national level, nearly 20% of GDP going to healthcare. That's not very sustainable if we want to do infrastructure stuff. But also I hear from more and more people who are now spending 20, 30, sometimes even 50% of their household income on healthcare costs. That's often not with anything more than insurance and a knee replacement or something relatively minor. That's not sustainable. I now work at Kaiser Health News, which is a nonprofit news service of the Kaiser Family Foundation. It has nothing to do with Kaiser Permanente or Kaiser Hospitals, but we do surveys, and about a third of people with insurance now say they're having trouble affording health care. So that's a pretty damning statistic. People from other countries look at our healthcare system and say, why do you guys put up with this? And I'm a storyteller, so the first part of the book is about stories, to see what we're putting up with, because I think part of how this has gotten this way is we all tend to experience healthcare in our kitchens, our living rooms. We look at the bill, we think, that's nuts. How much do I have to pay? We may go back and forth with the hospital. We solve it for ourselves. And we don't coalesce into a greater voice saying, we can't afford this anymore. We tend to think of our problems as personal when they're national. And we're a little bit embarrassed to talk about, I can't afford this healthcare. I spoke to someone today over at a luncheon who had part of her colon taken out a year and a half ago, and she is still paying off the bills from that, even though she has insurance, but she has a high deductible, $15,000 deductible plan, and she hasn't done the follow-up for her surgery because she's afraid of how much it's going to cost. And she came to me and said, what should I do? Am I doing the right thing? And it's an awful question to have to ask, and it's an awful question to have to answer because there isn't a good answer. So anyway, people from other countries look at us and say, why do you put up with this? I put some of them in the book. A German who was visiting San Francisco, and people won't visit the U.S. now because they're afraid of, like, what happens if I get in an accident and I need to go to the emergency room. One guy, German, who was in San Francisco for a few months, he got in a minor bike crash. He got taken, and this is a warning to everyone, an ambulance came. He wasn't that injured, but he thought, well, maybe the better part of valor is to get in the ambulance. So he got in the ambulance. He was delivered by ambulance to San Francisco General Hospital, whereupon the triage nurse, again, thinking she was doing the right thing, called the trauma team. It's just not even before he rolled in the door, because you hear someone who's in a bike crash, is coming in by ambulance, you alert the trauma team. What neither of them knew, neither the German guy who got in the ambulance nor the triage nurse who alerted the trauma team, is that calling a trauma team at a lot of hospitals today involves, at San Francisco General and at many hospitals, the price differs, but a $10,000 trauma activation fee. So, and that's not okay, and that's not, I'm sure the doctors on the trauma team don't know it's being built that way. So I think this is the kind of thing we're up against that happens in, behind the scenes. In the book, there's also people I call healthcare refugees, Americans who leave because they're afraid of healthcare costs here or who don't come back. There's one woman who's living in Turkey named Tiffany Spivey. She chose to stay there to have her second child rather than come back, and she said she had 20,000 reasons. The price of an even cheap delivery in the U.S. today. Another woman, and again, this is sad when we're thinking about our talent pool, who's finishing a PhD at Wash University in St. Louis, who's only looking for postdocs and jobs in other countries because she has type 1 diabetes. And even with good insurance, the cost of pumps and the cost of insulin in this country are going through the roof. The insulins in this country, the long-acting insulins, have risen in price by about 400% and in the last 5 years. And that's because of a patent dispute, not because of the insulin. That doesn't happen in other countries. sorry, a few more stories, and you can read more of them. But I really want to put a name and a face to each of these problems and to examine how we got here. Because I think everyone has a tipping point and of outrage, and most of the people in the book have reached that tipping point, and that's why they contacted me, just so you know. Everyone who's in the book and everyone who was in my New York Times series, the Pain Till It Hurts series, was someone who contacted me through social media outreach, through my Facebook group I run called the Pain Till It Hurts Facebook group. That was the name of the series. That series got 20,000 comments. I had 20,000 stories and a lot of knowledge that I didn't have when I wrote the individual New York Times articles to write a book because I understood much better how all the system fit together, how one part of the system fueled the other, how in an era where 20 years ago when I started practicing, when insurance pretty much covered everything, how it was easy to feel like nobody was paying, so you saw the price of an office visit that might have been $20 in my dad's time when someone had to actually hand over cash to, well, if nobody's really paying, why don't we charge $200 or $500? And then what you see around the turn of the century are, and again, there's a pretty devastating story told by a young consultant for Deloitte around the turn of the century about how she and her colleagues would go into hospitals and teach them how to be more efficient. And what does more efficient mean in a business context? It doesn't mean at that point necessarily doing things more efficiently. It meant how do you change how you build to generate more revenue for the things you're doing now? And that was kind of the seed for what we now see, the Tylenol that's billed at $17, and it just has spiraled up and up and up and up. So now, you know, when I was practicing, the ER doctor was part of the ER visit. Now you go into an emergency room, if you've seen a bill, there's the facility fee, there's the ER doctor fee, there's the oxygen fee where they put the little monitor on your finger. There's the blood test. I mean, everything is billed. Everything that can be billed will be billed. So part of what they told the hospitals is, look, you have people sitting in the recovery room for 3 hours. You can bill that. And so they start billing that as a flat fee. And then someone comes in and says, it doesn't have to be a flat fee. You can bill by the minute. So now what you see on bills is, recovery room time, ambulance ride time, ambulance ride time being billed by the mile, and recovery room time being billed by in 15-minute segments. So, you know, it's been this inflationary spiral that pulled in not just hospitals, of course, but pharma. Drugs that used to be cheap got much more expensive. Insurers wanted in, device makers. And that's where we end up with some of the stories in the book. There was one woman named Heather Pierce Campbell, who's a lawyer in Seattle, who was in, I just feel like I might as well name names, in Swedish hospital for under 24 hours for a GYN operation. She got a bill for that stay of $45,000. She had a copay of $4,000. And the only thing it said on the bill was miscellaneous. You know, and that was what pushed her over the edge. It wasn't even the $45,000. It was the miscellaneous. So she said, you know, as we would in any other part of our consumer life, you know, I'm not paying I don't want my insurer paying for miscellaneous. I don't want to pay my copay for miscellaneous. And she did what I think we all need to do, is to say, what's it for? And when they sent her a next round saying, you know, what's become the common itemized bill in healthcare, you know, pharmacy, $8,000. Supplies, you know, $10,000. She said, no, that's not itemized. I don't know, you know, how would you go to a grocery store and it said, you know, groceries, you know, $200? No, you would want to know what you're paying for. So she filed a complaint with the Washington State Consumer Protection Board, and that's still in process. Another woman who you can meet in the book is someone named Mary Chapman, who's a wonderful woman who has a pretty serious case of progressive multiple sclerosis. The drugs for MS have become much, much better since I was practicing medicine. I mean, people are leading much more mobile and productive lives. But the drugs, as they've come into play, undergo this phenomenon called sticky pricing. I don't know if anyone's heard of that. So what it means is there are a whole lot of drugs now that treat MS, and they've never been, well, that's another story, but every year or so a new drug comes in, and the drug maker tries out a higher price. So now they're up to all around $6,500. And what happens, instead of that competition between all the drugs bringing down the price, they all look and say, ooh, you know, people are prescribing it at $6,500. And they all raise their price up to that sticky ceiling. So what we see are drugs that in the rest of the world, when you ask how do drugs get so expensive here, it's often through that phenomenon of sticky pricing. Now, in other countries, they'll say either, what's this drug worth, and set a price. And so there's no sticky pricing. You can't increase the price that way. Or as in Japan, which uses a very interesting model, is you can bring drugs in at a high price, but over time, every 2 years, that price has to come down because these are no longer new drugs. They're older drugs. You know, there are a lot of different solutions. Medicare could be able to negotiate. We could do drug imports. You call doctors in other countries about the price of some of these medications. I called an MS specialist at the National Health Service and told him what they were charging here. And there's just like this dead silence at the other end of the phone. Like, really? Why would anyone pay that? You know, and the answer is because we're kind of stuck, right? Another story. I mean, every time I try and decide which stories to tell for a talk, there's so many that I find mind blowing. Another one I really like is one about. Has anyone seen the ad for television ads for pharmaceuticals? It really makes me a little nuts. So I don't know. I'm a late night news junkie. Has anyone seen the ad for a product, a disease called Non-24? And wondered, like, what's that about? So I decided, I would find out what all that's about. So Non-24 is a condition, it's a sleep-wake cycle disorder suffered by people who are totally blind, where they can't sleep at night very well because they lack the visual cues. It affects, and I started researching, as a journalist too, you know, I started saying, well, what is this? So it affects at most about 70,000 Americans, if that's the maximum it could possibly affect. And I thought, so why is this being advertised on TV? You know, what's the get here? So anyway, I looked at the minutes of the FDA approval process to get a sense of, like, what is this drug? Where did it come from? And what... I discovered that it's quite an interesting transcript. There was an approval panel that included a bunch of neurologists and sleep experts. One of them was a guy named Dr. Robert Sack, who's at the Oregon Health Sciences Center. He's a sleep expert, and he actually, in the 1990s, first described this condition called Non-24. And over the course of the 90s, figured out that it could be treated with doses of melatonin. So Dr. Sack's question was what, and what I discovered is that this new drug that that treats non-24 is, it's called Hetlioz, and it's a melatonin analog. So you can't patent melatonin, right, because it's a natural occurring substance. But you can add a little group to it that hits the same receptors, and then you can patent it, and you can try and sell it as a drug. So this company had been trying to get melatonin analog onto the sleep product market for years without very much success, because when it was tested against, Lunesta and Ambien, it just wasn't that great. As we know, melatonin it's okay, but it's not, it's not as strong as some of these others. So they hadn't been able to, they decided that there was no market for it as a pure sleep aid. And then they went after this niche population who had non-24. And the reason that was good for a pharmaceutical manufacturer, now you'll see how much calculation goes on that has nothing to do with the kind of research and development that we say we want. There's something called the Orphan Drug Act that was passed in 1983, and it said if you're developing a drug for an underserved population, that means underserved in the sense of has a rare disease, of under 200,000 Americans, we're not going to ask very much of you to prove that it works. The trials only have to involve a few dozen patients, and they can last only a few months. So instead of investing millions of dollars to do a trial of tens of thousands of patients to get this drug approved for non-24, they enrolled about 50 patients. It went on for 3 months. And you know what? When you looked at the results of the trial, as Dr. Sack did when he was on this panel, it wasn't very good. They decided to look at the worst 25 nights of sleep. And in those worst 25 nights of sleep among the 50 volunteers, they got about an extra 42 minutes of sleep a night. So it went from 3 hours and 20 minutes to about 4 hours. And you see the panelists on the FDA panel asking these questions like of this pharmaceutical firm saying, gee, an extra 40 minutes of sleep to less than 4 hours, that's not really good. That doesn't seem like a great improvement. And the pharmaceutical firm, which had flown in patients who said that blindness wasn't a problem, non-24 was their issue, treated these neurologists and sleep experts like kind of heartless louts. They were like, how can you say 4 hours? If you were only getting 3 hours and 20 minutes, you would think 4 hours is great. Another physician in the mix said, why don't they just take melatonin? And the answer was, well, melatonin is, we're not marketing melatonin. That's not the question we're asking here. We're asking for our new drug, Hetlioz. So they're all really uncomfortable with it. But what were they playing to? They're, again, playing to the FDA rules and standards, which were set in the middle of the last century, which said only that drugs have to be safe and effective, right? We knew this drug was safe because it's basically melatonin, right? So it passed that test easily. Then came the effective. Well, because in the middle of the last century, drug development was pretty new. There weren't a lot of different drugs. Effective meant effective compared to placebo, and we've stayed with that standard. So to get drug approval for this drug, no one had to compare it to melatonin. No one had to compare it to any other sleep aid. They just had to prove that it was more effective than doing nothing. And it was, 40 minutes more effective than doing nothing for a very niche population. And so you see this wonderful kind of hesitation on the part of the panel who are saying, and I interviewed Dr. Sack for the book, who said, we were all really uncomfortable because the standard we were given was, is it safe and effective compared to nothing? And by that standard, we had to approve it. The FDA did approve it on the basis of the panel's recommendation. You don't see all the ambivalence in the transcripts. And the panel thought, how much can they charge for this? It's just melatonin. You know, it's not. That drug hit the market with a monthly price of $8,000 a month. One analyst calculated that they only had to get physicians to write about 1,000 prescriptions to make money. But anyway, the goal of many of these companies is not to actually sell a drug. It's to be bought by investors. And this company did go public. It had a nice initial stock offering. And I think now I'm seeing what the get was for that advertising. Why we're seeing it on TV now, it's because, you know, what's a sleep-wake disorder that involves light that we all suffer from? It's jet lag. And I think they are now doing phase two trials for jet lag. Now, I don't know who's going to write a script for $8,000 a month for jet lag. However, and this is the last part of this pharmaceutical story, when the detail people from the pharmaceutical company go to your doctor and tell them about a fabulous new drug, they tell them how fabulous the new drug is. They don't tell them what the price is. So, you know, there's one of my other favorite, like, non-pharmaceuticals that I looked at was a drug called Duexis, which is a combination of an over-the-counter non-steroidal like Advil or Motrin or ibuprofen and an over-the-counter acid blocker like Pepcid. You put the two of them together, you say to the physician, we've got this great new drug, a lot of people who are taking non-steroidals have stomach upset, so we're making it easy for your patients. It's called Duexis, it's great, just write the script. $1,500 a month for those two over-the-counter drugs, so, you know, not okay. And these drugs don't sell in any other country because no other country has this system of advertising and of drug approvals that we do. So, anyway, so beyond that, I guess you'll see how in the first part of the book this all unravels, how people come to terms with it or don't, how people realize it. Often I find it's from going to another country. The one guy in the book who has had a long history of kidney stones, who had his typical kidney stone while at a spa in Japan, right? And so he went through the same drill, including a Japanese doctor with Google Translate trying to help him. At the end of the visit, when his kidney stone had passed, they said, oh, we don't take credit cards, and he was pretty concerned about that. But then he learned that the total price of his day at the clinic there was $263, so compared to his $10,000 plus visits in emergency rooms here. So I don't want this just to be a depressing, you know, wow, we're doomed and, you know, we're going to be paying forever and bankrupted by this. Because the point of the second part of the book is really that we don't have to put up with this, that there are things we can do, and we tend to feel very helpless when confronted with this system. But there are many ways to make it better, both for you as you're seeking health care, and those things will eventually help make it better for the country. You know, the first step, I think, is to understand how it evolved in this way so you understand that it's not necessary, you know, that we don't get better care. When I first started writing about the ACA, when I came back to the U.S., I was writing this phrase over and over again, which I'm sure you've all heard when we talk about health reform. You know, we want patient-centered, evidence-based care. You know, patient-centered, evidence-based care. And I'd written that 100 times as a journalist. And then when I started researching the book, I read that phrase and I thought, like, wait, what other kind of health care could there possibly be? You know, that is what health, you know, it is patient-centered, it's evidence-based. And the answer, of course, is, you know, finance-incentivized healthcare, which is what we're seeing now. So what can we do? That's where the second part of the book comes in. And I think part of it is we as patients have to feel entitled to ask these questions and not be bullied by a system which, you know, will send you a bill with miscellaneous and you know, which has in the top, you know, 20% prompt payment discount in the hopes that you'll just write the check. You know, my people always say to me, what's your first piece of advice? And it's always, don't write the check. You know, and that doesn't mean ignore the bills. It means don't write the check. You know, think before you write it. So I have a lot of advice about, it's kind of stepwise, about how to approach that process as a patient. I know that it works because my last 2 years at the New York Times, I became like the unofficial bill consultant troubleshooter for everyone in the building. And so, you know, people would have like a heart valve replaced and come in and dump this pile of papers on my desk and say, what do I do? And you know, what I realized is what I knew from studies is, first of all, 50 to 90% of hospital bills contain errors. So you have to look at them. And sometimes they'll be in code, but sometimes the errors will be really obvious. For example, a patient in the book who he and his wife had a son at a hospital in San Francisco, and they were billed for a circumcision. Well, he knew his son hadn't been circumcised. You know, his insurer didn't know that. So another patient in the book who was medevaced to a hospital in Virginia for subarachnoid hemorrhage, a very serious brain bleed who came out okay, there was an $80,000 charge on her bill for outpatient surgery. She'd never been an outpatient. She'd been, you know, so I think it's worth looking at these bills. And, you know, the odd thing is you will not be able to do anything about the $17 Tylenols. That's allowed. It's legal. And that's often the answer you get, which is like, and as a reporter even, I would call and say, can you explain this? And they would go, it's legal. And I would go, yeah, I know it's legal, but, you know, justify it to me. Justify why these prices are what they are. It's hard to get. The justification I got for some of the hospital charges at some of the Sutter hospitals in San Francisco, and I credit the CEO of the hospital for talking to me about it, was, and you hear this over and over again, well, you know, no one really pays that. So we have to keep inflating the prices because the insurers bargain down the price. And, you know, that becomes a real arms race with patients caught in the middle. And the other thing he said, which he probably shouldn't have said on the record because I put it in the newspaper, was, well, sometimes, you know, a really rich foreigner comes with a suitcase full of cash, and they do pay the price. And I'm like, ooh, that's not a good justification. And it's not a good justification for, you know, a hospital as that one where hip and knee replacements cost over $100,000, where we know they can be done for high quality at probably $40,000, and where a patient I followed who went to Belgium for his because his insurance wouldn't cover it, got it done for $13,000, including airfare. And so, you know, what's the real value of this? Now, part of the problem in the U.S. is our hospitals are over the barrel when it comes to those joint implants that they have to buy. You know, if the joint manufacturer can get away with charging $25,000, then a $30,000 allowed charge may not sound very good. In Belgium, that joint, that piece of metal and plastic goes for about $3,000 to $4,000 because there's national pricing where the government and the doctors negotiate with the joint manufacturers for what they consider a reasonable price. So the first thing is open the bills, look at them, ask for real itemization and see what you see. The second thing I think we should ask for is a greater level of transparency in billing, which I think will lead to, and people always say, well, you know, what can I do with transparency? Well, at a lower level, and I use this now also, when I go to my physician who says, my accident-prone self, you need to get your knee x-rayed. I'll say to him now, okay, there are 25 different x-ray centers within a few blocks of here in Manhattan. Can you tell me which one will charge $100 rather than $2,000 for this test? He doesn't know that the first time I ask. But over time, I want him to send me, to learn that, and send me to the one that charges $100, and to say to the one that's charging $2,000, I'm not going to send my patients to you because I don't like you ripping off my patients. And at a time when we're paying more and more out of pocket, it's a terrible burden to put on patients and on their physicians, but I think, you know, the alternative is to be stuck with the $2,000 bill, which I think none of us wants. Likewise, I think people have to understand with hospitals, again, bad position to be in, not fair, but that they're often very negotiable, which is also a weird thing I learned from researching the book. You know, the same person who had the subarachnoid hemorrhage was medevaced, I mentioned, from to the University of Virginia Medical Center. She was charged $45,000 for the flight. Her insurance didn't cover it. And she said, I don't have that kind of money. I'll give you, she went online and researched what a reasonable price for a medevac was and said, I'll give you $15,000. And they said, we'll take it. You know, I would argue she should have bargained harder. But again, there are more and more online tools that you can use to set, if you're not comfortable actively negotiating, which I'm probably not, I'm pretty timid about that, but you can question bills. You can go on to sites like Clear Health Costs or Fair Health or Prater or Healthcare Blue Book. They're all listed in the book. And say, what should a colonoscopy cost in this neck of the woods? And then you can use some of the letter templates I put in the book because I use them for my colleagues at the New York Times to say, I'm not paying this bill now because I see that, you know, I had X procedure on X date and you charge me blah, 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 but I see that the average price charge for this procedure in my zip code is only X, so will you be open to reducing it to this price? And I think what we'll find more and more if more of us feel enabled or empowered to do this is you'll find that a lot of places will. I mean, it would be even better, and I think this is one thing we should all go ask our employers, if our employers did that for us. Some big employers in California do what's called reference pricing. So they'll say, what does it cost to have a good hip replacement in California? And I think they set the reference price at about $43,000. I can't remember. And they said to their insurers, okay, this is what we're going to pay. And anyone who wants to go to a place that costs more than that, they're going to pay themselves. So that accomplished two really interesting goals. One was that it gave the employees incentive to look for a center that came in below the reference price. But also, to me, the more interesting thing was because these were big employers that represented a lot of patients, a lot of covered lives, a lot of the hospitals that had been charging $100,000 said, okay, we can do it for that. We'll match the reference price. So it kind of, you know, if there is pushback from patients and employers, the system does have the capacity to respond. But as long as we're not asking and our employers, who've been really, frankly, asleep at the wheel on this for many years, you know, we're going to get exactly the system we get. There's no control on price. There's no ceiling. There's no pushback. It seems like no one's paying. And so the prices will keep rising. I would like to see also a patient bill of rights that included the ability to know prices of low-level things in a doctor's office. There are price lists on the walls in France. That doesn't mean people decide their care based on those price lists, but it does mean that no hospital would charge $11,000 for a colonoscopy because you wouldn't put that on your wall. It would be embarrassing, right? A lot of what happens in our system happens because it happens in darkness. In Australia, it's considered a patient's right when they go in for an elective procedure, and this is supported by the Australian Medical Society, to have a binding estimate of the cost and their patient responsibility. Hospitals know this. They do it for Medicare. You know, why are we left holding the bag? And that's my kind of the constant theme in the second half of the book is we should not, it's partly because we've been a little complacent. We've been willing, and our employers have been willing, to hold the bag to a point where now that the bag is getting pretty heavy and pretty unsustainable, it's time to reverse that trend. What does this mean for Washington? That's a different problem. But I think we should all become healthcare voters at the local and state levels, because we've seen in issues like gay marriage, right to die, legalization of marijuana, a lot of changes may start at the state level, because the states feel much more the local anger of their constituents. Just a little example that I hope everyone will pay attention to from now on. The insurance commissioners in every state who have a fair amount of power to regulate insurance plans, to at least review premium increases, and to make sure, be in my bonnet, that those directories that are so horribly inaccurate are accurate. They are mostly elected or appointed officials, and now almost all of them are from the insurance industry. We should be electing people who are consumer advocates in those jobs. We should be asking our governor to appoint someone who will stand up for patients rather than the insurers. California has a very activist insurance commissioner who actually, by their state charter, doesn't have that much power, is a guy named Dave Jones. But when an insurer tries to raise a premium by an absurd amount, in that state he doesn't have the power to say no, but he does have the power to, get on TV and complain a lot about it and make it really embarrassing for that insurer, and he doesn't. I guess I know this is a big ask, but look up your 990 forms for your local hospital. Again, as good citizens, these hospitals get huge tax breaks. They don't pay taxes for performing charity care and community benefit. Look at their operating surplus. It will tell you how much money they're actually making. These are all nonprofits, right? But they are quite profitable. And I think we should all decide for our communities if they are doing enough to deserve their tax breaks. And if they're not, we should ask more or say, pay your taxes. Someone said to me, Apple Computer gives away a lot of computers to schools, but that doesn't make them a charity, right? So I think look at the salaries of the highest paid executives, see if you're comfortable with that, and make some noise locally if you're not. Likewise, find out how your senators and congressmen are voting on issues about drug pricing. Every time there's a Martin Shkreli or a EpiPen crisis, there are hearings. There have been bipartisan bills proposed both to allow controlled importation from Canada, and both bipartisan support for allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices. Every time those things actually come up, they never pass. And it's partly because of how even some of the most liberal people in Congress are voting. They all take, it's a bipartisan take from pharmaceutical firms. And I think that's something we should be asking everyone about at their town halls and paying attention when we vote. It affects us all. That's kind of where I'm going to end. I'm just going to end with one little story, actually two little stories, of people who have started changing their interactions with the healthcare system. And it will be frustrating to begin with, so I want to give you a little humorous story. There was a woman named Kathleen Williams who was on a bike ride in Cincinnati, and she fell off her bike. She wasn't terribly badly hurt, but she knew her arm, she thought it might have been broken, and she was out on a bike ride. She didn't have a way to get to the hospital. Well, she could have called an Uber, an ambulance. Someone called the fire department ambulance, which was there because it was on one of these community bike rides. And they said, "Do you want us to take you to the hospital?" And she said, "Okay." So she gets taken to the hospital by the fire department ambulance. She is well insured by the biggest insurer in her part of Ohio. And a few weeks later, she gets a bill for about $900 and is informed that not only does the fire department not take people to the hospital for free, but that the fire department ambulance company doesn't participate in insurance. The fire department ambulance doesn't participate in insurance networks. So she has to pay. And she's pretty outraged by this, as you might imagine. So she calls the ambulance billing service and says this must be a mistake, and then she learns that it's not, in fact, a mistake. So she tries to bargain, and she says, okay, how about I give you $450? And they go, nope, you know, this was a service, and you have to pay it. She argues back and forth, complains to the fire department, complains to the mayor, doesn't get anywhere. So you always have the option, by law, of setting up a payment plan if you can't afford your bill. So what Kathleen Williams does is she sets up a payment plan under which she will pay $10 a month for the rest of her life for this. And she said, you know, it is the only thing I could do to protest. So, you know, I've had offers of people who said, will you come as a journalist, watch us pay in pennies this, you know, three things. So I think, you know, it will be frustrating, but the more we take this on, the more I think it will respond to us. And I wanted to read you, I always try and read from a little bit of local color. So I want, in terms of the charity care and what we get from our hospitals, I want to tell you about, and this is probably a good thing because there are no stories in the book from Ann Arbor directly, so maybe your hospitals are doing something right around here. But this is a story from Cadillac, Michigan, about 3 hours from here. It's called A Catholic Hospital Conglomerate Makes Off with an Old Man's Bequest. Okay, so it's very short. People were surprised when Harvey Pell, a parsimonious appliance store owner known for sensible old cars and polyester trousers, bequeathed $10 million to his local hospital in Cadillac, Michigan. The bulk of his donation to Cadillac Hospital was earmarked to start a foundation to help the hospital pay for important services it couldn't otherwise fund. Mr. Pell left his daughter $40,000, his housekeeper $10,000, and his grandchildren nothing. Most hospitals in America were established to meet very local needs, struggling valiantly to provide quality basic medical services, stitches, removing an infected gallbladder, setting a broken bone. If you needed a heart transplant or cancer chemotherapy, you might head to an urban medical center. But for everything else, the local hospital was there. And patients like Mr. Pell, who died in his mid-90s, were grateful. Okay, so in 1978, with revenues beginning to roll in from all the insured patients, Cadillac built a new hospital. That was a boom time for hospital building. For a time, it was managed by Sisters of Mercy. It ultimately came under the ownership umbrella of the healthcare conglomerate Trinity Health, which by the 21st century had become one of the largest multi-institutional Catholic health delivery systems in the nation, with 92 hospitals coast to coast. In May 2014, Trinity announced that it had decided to sell Cadillac Hospital to Munson Healthcare, another big medical corporation active in Michigan. Paychecks would thereafter come from Munson. The building, scanners, beds, and wheelchairs henceforth belonged to Munson. But Trinity would keep Mr. Pell's $10 million bequest. So, and this is how I get stories. Katie Huckle, a local banker and friend of the Pell family, resigned from the hospital board in protest. She wrote to me at the time, "People are behaving really badly, and I think they thought this would fly under the radar." During months of secretive deal planning, no one had advised Mr. Pell's grandchildren or grandchildren that the hospital was being sold and that Trinity was keeping the bequest, even though family members were on the hospital board. A hospital delegation visited Ginny Mackey, Mr. Pell's now elderly daughter, on New Year's Eve. In conveying notice of their plan, they brought along a nun. The grandchildren were furious. Trinity said it would make sure the funds were spent in the best interest of the hospital. His granddaughter, Helen James Lehman, wrote to the local bishop, Stephen J. Reka, asking for help. It was grandfather's intent to keep this money in Cadillac, to be managed, invested, and spent in Cadillac. The bishop sent an emotional letter to Trinity Health asking it to reconsider and invoking the very principle of respecting the intention of donors. In March 2015, I received a final note from Ms. Huckle. My beloved family got screwed. To not even negotiate with us is hooey. So again, you know, I think you have to realize that the business of healthcare is often cloaked in noble statements and in noble clothes, but it's not always so noble anymore. So, thank you.